Lewis? So over the course of the past 2 days, we've had a number of conversations about different ways that life relates to form. And we started with some of the canonical Peircean ways, right? After C.S. Peirce, with deduction and induction. And now we're going to go a little bit far afield and talk about a way of relating to life and form that wasn't proposed by Peirce, which is, instead of deduction and induction, thinking about construction and how people can try to reason about life by reference to construction. And I know this is something that we've both thought about, given our interest in synthetic biology. So one way of posing the question that I want to ask is, when you think about the distance that separates life as it is from life as it could be, where does the constructive impulse fit into that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I have found so interesting in looking at this question of what, of how life could be, of how it may have been, of how it might be in the future, of how we might find it somewhere else, is that these categories that seem so obviously separate to us sometimes have shared histories. Sometimes people involved in one area are deeply involved in another, or an analytical distinction that we make doesn't exist for the actors themselves. When I think of the origin of life, when I think of a moment that has often been referred to as dividing one side from another, right, of non-life from life, the moment when that becomes a historical question that can be answered with experiment is a moment that involves creating something that's almost alive but not quite alive. Right. The idea being of something that could be produced in the laboratory that would have n minus one of the n properties of life, whatever that would be.
So here are you thinking of sort of proofs of concept like the synthesis of urea, or reimagining something else?
So the synthesis of urea has often been pointed to as an example of that, and that's what I think is interesting about that is that's a story from 1828, if I remember right, and yet that wasn't what Wöhler himself thought he was doing, but others have looked to that and have claimed that as an originary moment. Right. And I think we're often claiming originary moments to think about the origin of life. If it's 1828, if it's 1953, zapping some gases in a container and producing some amino acids, the Urey Miller experiment from 1953. But I thought my
Which
way back
also
to
the year of the demonstration of the structure of DNA, right?
That's right, absolutely. Yeah, and that's a thread we should return to, since we have a thread that was lined out for us right here on the floor. But I thought my way back to 1904 and to somebody who looked around him and thought about the early Earth, thought about fossils, and I know you've thought a lot about fossils, and he thought, well, the early Earth must have been more intensely radioactive. It must have been a place that had lots of rays flying around, that might have something to do with the creation of life. Yeah. And I just said creation. I think we should also talk about creation and construction as different words that get used to talk about.
Yeah, I think about that a lot.
Making of life, yeah. And so what he did is he thought he could make life in the test tube, or N minus one properties of it, this physicist who was entranced by the properties of radioactivity. And so he put some radium into some beef soup and saw some things that began to grow and subdivide over the space of a few weeks. And he took some photos of them and began to publish it. And so he argued that these things were the microbe's ancestor, that they were, you know, coming out of a lively element that seemed to have energy coming from nowhere, that there must have been more of it early on, and therefore that could explain where life might have come from. What I think is interesting is that that experiment has an inherent instability in it. When we think about being able to produce something that might crawl out of the test tube or otherwise be proof of life for us, we don't often think of the complexities, the criticisms that are made of it, and how that destabilizes that experiment as having one meaning. Lots of people attacked him for this as being a rather stupid and uninformed experiment to do, that these were just precipitates that had been created chemically. And he said, no, 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 if I had produced life, then you would have thought this was contamination. So it's the very fact that I didn't produce it, and I produced something else that you have a hard time understanding, is what makes my experiment so interesting and so useful. Mm-hmm. And that argument didn't work. It's a brilliant argument, but it didn't work. And so that question of how do we make it, how do we know it, and how can making something help us understand how nature may have done something is, I think, a question that's been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the question of how do you know it when you see it is something that I've been grappling with as well, because I've been looking at the history of something called a Dubio fossil. I don't know if you're familiar with the Dubio fossil, but it's a fossil that people are dubious about. People find a pattern in stone and they think it might be a fossil, but it also might not be. And there are plenty of examples of things that look like they're alive, that they take the form of life, but in fact aren't. And we can talk about, you know, going back to protoplasm as a very early example of that, right? Mm-hmm. Dredging the seafloor in the 1860s.
So you're thinking of Haeckel and Bathybius. Is that the name of the
Bathybius Haeckeli. So actually, Haeckel did not look at Bathybius Haeckeli. Mm-hmm. It was named in honor of him by his student. And it did turn out to be just sea slime, right? Even though it got a Latin name. But there are lots of examples of that that continue up until the present. And even if you look at, you know, the cover of Science or Nature as of, let's see, September, the announcement that there were 3.67 billion-year-old fossils is actually a Dubio fossil, because there's a lot of argument about it. And so I've been trying to pay attention to moments where there are these controversies and what counts as form and what doesn't. And in fact, it's actually quite surprising, because I found that the things that people think look least like lifelike are more likely to be readily accepted. So form becomes something about which people are dubious when it comes to identifying life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes me think of back in the Middle Ages when Albert the Great saw what we would understand to be fossils and saw that as a clear astrological influence. This is the heavens that are creating the rocks to form in that particular way. So there, the clarity of the form was the argument for it. But now we've entered into maybe a different place where to have a clear form is to be, to make us suspicious, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
I saw a Dubio fossil, now that I have the word for that, just a couple weeks ago,
welcome.
Or a couple months ago, at the Smithsonian, in one of the museums there. They have an insect trapped in amber. And I looked at it, and then they told me what it was. And it was the prop from Jurassic Park. And I thought, this is brilliant. I was so taken by it at first, and it was too good, right? It was too perfect. It was the perfect form. And of course, it resonated with something deep in my childhood of watching this movie and then becoming a historian of biology, right? What a happy origin story that would be. And so I looked at it and I thought, you know, it's amazing that I can be so convinced as I stare at this thing that it is a symbol of something, that it is a fossil, even though I know in my mind it's not.
Right.
And the form belies the truth
right.
in that case, yeah.
Yeah, and in my first book, I write about what I call persuasive objects. So the claim that I make is synthetic biologists who are bioengineers trying to understand what life is or what the limits of life might be make really simple organisms or even less than organisms, genetic material, biological systems in the laboratory in order to convince themselves that the kinds of criteria or characteristics that they think of as being definitional of life are in fact true. So, you know, a very simplified virus will function as proof of concept or a persuasive object because it persuades them of what life might be. But given what you just said, one of the things that I should think more about is whether sometimes people are persuaded of things that aren't necessarily so.
Mm-hmm.
But if anything, as a mode of logical reasoning, it's, I don't want to say circular because it's by reference to a future, right? But it is a way of kind of fastening upon particular characteristics, building them into substance, and then being convinced that what you thought was true because you've made it.
Is there a particular story you have in mind?
A story about
About
persuasive
making those
objects?
Persuasive objects in synthetic biology, yeah.
Well, I have a few.
Because I have another Dubio fossil story that's related to that.
You have a story. Okay,
so
why don't you tell a
well,
story?
I'm thinking because when you mentioned synthetic biology, I thought of Craig Venter and the nanobacteria, supposedly from Mars, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And that he saw that as an inspiration. A Dubio fossil was an inspiration for coming up with this idea of making a minimal organism with a minimal genome.
Right.
And so he succeeded in that, of course, right? And so the idea of of having something that was a dubio fossa lead to an actual result is maybe an interesting example of a persuasive object.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he doesn't want to call himself a synthetic biologist.
He hasn't done what?
He doesn't want to call himself a synthetic biologist.
No.
Yeah. He wants to call himself after his company, Synthetic Genomics.
Well, so, the last thing I want to do is talk about Craig Venter today.
Well, that's why I said, is there another story?
Yeah. Right. Well, so one of the other things I was thinking about was how constructive biology or constructive reasoning more broadly could be thought of not just as constructive but as demonstrative, right? These persuasive objects demonstrate something. They show that it could be true, and you're doing that by reference to making things.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was contemplating the word demonstrative, I recalled that the root of demonstrative is the same as monster, which actually makes sense. So let me follow this thread for a second. When we talk about what a monster is, right, we think of something that's abnormal or something that's disturbing, right? Monsters coming from the laboratory would be one way of thinking about the kinds of things that constructive biologists do. But I was also thinking about the word's original meaning, which is a wonder or an omen or a demon, right? So these are things that, because they're abnormal, suggest that something catastrophic is about to happen. And there's, you know, as you know, many books about the origins of modern science being tied up with wonderment, but also the worry that these kinds of monstrosities are saying something about how order is being disturbed. So I was thinking about whether that's another way that we could find an inroad into this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that kind of reference to etymology, I think, is a really useful technique that we get to use in the humanities all the time, right? How can words reveal things to us in their aspects and virtues as words, right? How can we uncover these meanings that are sometimes forgotten in how we talk about things today? That monster and demonstration share the same root, that it's wonder, it's omen, it's demon, all these things at one time.
Mm.
And I think it is an endlessly fascinating way to have as a method, because you're always able to unfold and find other meanings and things that that are always there, but that you may not know until you do the work to uncover it, right? And I wonder sometimes if that is also how science works at a level that's not conscious to the scientists who are practicing it themselves.
Yeah, how do you mean?
That the words that they're using, the metaphors that they're appropriating or transporting to a new place, end up being, in some cases, very fruitful and very productive, and maybe happening without any conscious intent. And so I find that an interesting question to think about. If the thing that we recognize as being central to how it is that we reason,
mm-hmm.
that finding
mm-hmm.
these associations between words and playing with them enables us to reach new insights,
mm-hmm.
it's a form of making knowledge from serendipity, almost, that you're gathering cases and putting them together and learning new things. I wonder if that might be a useful, productive, different way to talk about what it is that scientists do as well.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about it less in terms of science, although obviously rhetoric studies and discourse analysis shows how much metaphors are embedded in scientific practice.
Yeah.
But I mean, for my own work, I'm really interested in how constructing new kinds of words, neologisms, but also wordplay can be a kind of theoretical work.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is it's a way of, or one thing that it does, is level the playing field between theory and empiricism. What I mean is, instead of just describing the world as it is and then putting some analysis on top, right? So theory being second order after the description of the world as it really is,
mm-hmm.
that theorizing is actually work that you do that not only shapes the world, but is something that, you know, as historians, the actors that we're writing about are doing, or as an anthropologist, the people that I write about are doing, they're analyzing and theorizing along with us. And so this produces a kind of, you know, what some people have referred to as lateral thinking, right? So scientists are thinking in one way, we're working with the same theories, but maybe torquing them or shifting them a little bit, and we're all engaged in the same kind of labor. We're not just, you know, being social science scientists describing the world on behalf of someone else, right? With all of the power differentials that might entail.
So if I return to that question I had earlier then about creation and construction, that might be a way to tap into that. So how have you seen those words being deployed and used in synthetic biology in your field work?
So I have a good story about that. When I was first doing research in a synthetic biology laboratory, I tell a story about a lab meeting I went to. And in the lab meeting, there was a first-year graduate student who was very nervous. He was giving a presentation for the first time. And he described this virus that they were working on. They were redesigning the virus, as they put it. They were streamlining the genome, taking bits of genetic material out to see how much they could remove and still have a viable virus, which of course is already complicated because viruses are only marginally alive, so we could talk about what that means. But the point was, he started a sentence and he said, well, you know, what we intended when we created this virus, and it was immediately apparent that he had made a huge social faux pas because people who hadn't been paying attention...
When we created this virus.
People, you know, put down what they were doing or... I want to say they put down their phones, but this was before iPhones.
This is before phones. Imagine the time.
And turned to look at him, and suddenly the room went completely quiet. And the PI of the lab said, we don't create, we construct. And that was a way of, as I later realized at the time, I was totally confused what had happened, but I realized that it was a way of trying to argue against intelligent designers. And this is kind of counterintuitive, but a lot of people who believe in intelligent design were very excited about synthetic biology because they thought, if PhDs at MIT are having a hard time doing it, obviously it couldn't have happened spontaneously. And in an effort to distance themselves from creationism or intelligent design, they completely eradicated the word create from their vocabulary.
That's interesting. So I have an echo, and I often have historical echoes that burp up in my mind when I hear stories like this from the present day. I think of Luther Burbank from the end of the 19th century, who bred new kinds of flowers and fruits and tried to produce useful things, white blackberries and spineless cactuses and things like that. And he produced a catalog where he sold these new things, and he called them new creations. And he got in trouble for calling them new creations, and in fact was invited to a church and seated in the front row as a guest of honor and harangued for 45 minutes for having created these new types of flowers that God surely could not have intended.
Right.
So to find kind of that deeper, longer history of this concern coming up where that word in particular, creation, is something that has drawn attention.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. So I wanted to get back to what we were saying before about demonstrative and monsters. That one of the things that I was thinking was, since we're talking about construction, right, as a mode of reasoning, and I realized that the form of Percian logic that we haven't talked about yet, or that we'll talk about soon, is abduction, right? Which is theorizing about the present by reference to a future. And the monster is perhaps an example of abductive reasoning because it's pointing toward a potentially catastrophic future about which you're supposed to respond in advance.
But so, maybe one could argue in the 20th century the monster becomes the mutant.
Certainly, yes, right. Especially in the context of the laboratory, right? Yeah. The mutant is the monster is the mutant. Mm-hmm. I mean, monsters have better, you know, theological resonances than mutants, I think. But that, of course, the notion of abductive made me realize that, you know, abduction has lots of meanings. So we've already talked about monsters. Maybe it's time to talk about aliens.
Time to talk about aliens. I like that. Okay. Different forms of abduction. Yeah. And because I'm from New Mexico, I'm the expert in this, right?
I'm sure you are.
So... I think maybe an interesting bridge between those is Julian Huxley, who in the 1930s was talking about the prospects for biology that being almost limitless, and that we might find ourselves in the position of being the business managers for evolution. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole other metaphor floating around there, right? To be a business manager is different than to be a god, and is different than to be a scientist. But
much less fun.
I'm sorry?
Much less fun.
Much less fun, yeah. Well, he thought it was interesting, but then again, he was one of the founders of UNESCO, right? So he liked administrative work. But that idea of space itself being a space to think about the futures of life, of how we might encounter it somewhere else, or of what might be necessary for us to travel elsewhere. J.D. Bernal, another figure from around that time, 1929, wrote a book called The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, and that these were the enemies of the rational soul, and that we needed to overcome these. So the world was we needed to leave the earth. The flesh was that we needed to do deliberate interventions in our own human germplasm and radically transform ourselves for a future that we might have in space. And the devil was how to deal with our desires and our fears, and I think he said our imaginations and our stupidities. that these were the different things to think about as we thought about what a future of humans in space might be like. But there's lots of talk of, and we've already had quite a bit of it today, about what life in space might be like, mm-hmm. Or life elsewhere, or how that story connects with the story here on Earth. And maybe if I can return...
I was going to say, I'm sure you have a story about
it. Yeah, maybe if I can return to an earlier thread then. One of these experts in mutants mm-hmm. At this time, in the first half of the 20th century, Herman J. Muller, had figured out how to use radiation to create mutants in fruit flies. He became very concerned about nuclear winter later on and nuclear testing that we were doing. But he also thought that we might have insights from this into how life might have emerged in other places and how we might manage to escape Earth if we need to at a certain time in the future. And he had, as it turns out, been a mentor to Carl Sagan. And so this was kind of a wonderful thread that brought together life as it could be, both of how he might engineer it by using radiation to produce new life forms, and he succeeded in doing that, and how it might be found in somewhere else. And so he and Carl Sagan read lots of science fiction. They went to science fiction conferences together. Muller was 68, Sagan was 23. This is a very unusual friendship that was established between them. And it turned out that Muller had often in his lectures talked about the chromosomes as the threads of destiny, as red threads, the threads we should pay attention to in a larger cord of history, the history of life on Earth. So he used to tell a story about thinking in geological times, if we took every yard, he said, every meter being about 10,000 years, how long this thread would extend, and that if we took a cross-section of this thread at any given moment in time to represent all life on Earth, about the size of an aspirin would be the amount of all the germplasm, all the genetic material that was there, and that this was the most important stuff in the world that we had to protect from the effects of radiation in a world full of nuclear testing. So in 1955, last year, I discovered that he had received a birthday card from Carl Sagan, and a birthday card that said, "The red thread weaves its way ever higher." And there's an image there of Mars, the best one they had available at the time.
On the birthday card.
Of Mars, yeah, an image of Mars on the birthday card. It was basically, that's all it was, with a red thread that was across it with that inscription at the top. And it took me a while to figure out that this was Carl telling the story back to Joe of how the story of life on Earth was a story that we should think about in outer space as well. What I love about that story is the instability in the meaning. Is that
right.
We should take life there, or is that life is also there and is related to us?
That's astonishing, right?
The thread is obvious there, but the thread also is lost because we don't know how to understand it.
Right, and so there's the thread of germplasm, there's life beyond Earth, there's the origin of life on Earth, there's also deep time.
Yep.
It's really astonishing, yeah.
And arguments about contingency and determinism also fit into that. Would life emerge in the right circumstances if given the chance, right? Are there many different ways that life could emerge in different places? And these have remained questions for a long time.
It's interesting that you bring that up because that's a question that my interlocutors in geobiology who study the origins of life on Earth are taking on. And they're also influenced by both Carl Sagan more in astrobiology, but Lynn Margulis, who happened to also be his first wife, although that was the least of her accomplishments by far, who worked in geobiology and developed the theory of symbiogenesis. But all of the people that I've been working with in that field, as I travel with them to look at ancient fossils, I realize they're all sci-fi fans. And one of the books that they recommend, well, they've recommended a lot of books to me, one of them is... this book called The Dechronization of Sam Magruder.
So that book was recommended to you. That book was unrecommended to me by somebody as an example of one of the worst science fiction books she had ever read.
It's horrible.
But because this person knew her paleobiology, I thought, well, then I have to read it, right? I have to know what the story is.
No, so, it's a terrible book. Yeah. And I mean, the author is George Gaylord Simpson, right, who's an invertebrate paleontologist, one of the giants of his generation. In Earth and Life Sciences, so he wasn't
and,
really.
And Simpson actually, I just read a letter the other day. Simpson had received a package, a new manuscript from Lynn, just when he was heading back home, and he was going to be reading her work. So he was. There's another genetic connection there, right? That
right,
Lynn Margulis's
right.
work is being commented on by this paleontologist thinking about these issues.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure there was a science fiction novel included in there somewhere, too.
If only Lynn Margulis had written a science fiction novel, that would be great. But no, George Gaylord Simpson did it, and the book is terrible, but it's quite interesting because he's trying to think about deep time, and the best way he can find to do it is by writing a time travel story, right, in which this person, who's clearly a thinly veiled version of Simpson himself, accidentally travels between time quanta and lands himself, I think, in the Triassic, if I remember correctly. It's like right around the KT boundary. Yeah. And so he kind of wiles away his time.
The only man in the world.
Eating dinosaur eggs and taking field notes in clay so that in hopes that someday they will be fossilized. And
now if I had seen him in amber, then I would have.
Hundreds of millions of years in the future, someone will read his field notes because they turned into fossils. And what I find really interesting about that is that this mode of reasoning, this attempt to inhabit deep time and try to understand what it is and how life might have developed, informed, deformed, transformed across deep time, requires this mode of thinking that we think of most of the time is highly unscientific. Mm-hmm. And we could describe it as abductive. I think we could also talk about its constructive aspects. Mm-hmm. But I think in this sense, there is a speculative way of reasoning about life and time that is very much genetically a part of scientific reasoning.
Yeah, yeah. And you see it very clearly in a book where he writes himself into the story, right?
Right.
Of traveling back in that time. And yet what's also an interesting feature of that story, if I remember right, and you've probably read it more recently than I have, is the loneliness that he talks about, of being the only man on the world. And, right. And then thinking about if he should help these little mammalian things to get to the next stage or not, mm-hmm. and if there's anything that can be done. So there is kind of both the speculative imaginary of traveling back in time and putting himself in that position, but also having the character then think if there is an obligation on them to undertake some sort of constructive action to accelerate evolution, even when one is thinking over millennial time spans.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's an interesting point. So what I've gotten away from myself, so we were talking about abduction and the abnormal and the monstrous, huh? And that got us to storytelling. So I guess one way of posing a question about this, if I have one, and not just, you know, a long series of comments, is sort of what is the place of storytelling in reasoning about the relationship of life to form, both in theories of origins of life in the lab or on Earth, but also life elsewhere?
Yeah. So I think coming up with a convincing narrative is obviously part of interpreting evidence and is part of convincing oneself that one has made sense of something, right? Mm. And so one can do that in many different forms. One can do that in formal scientific forms. One can do that thinking one's way through fiction. One can do that imagining oneself in a certain place to be able to make those connections. But it's interesting to think, is it the fact that these stories that are written in private, that are shared and circulated, that are read and used as ways to think, we should think of them as equivalent to laboratory notebooks, that they're other tools that we use to construct these realities.
What do you mean?
We sometimes want to make a distinction between the things that are finally proving that something is the case, right, and that's what is the real story, when it's these larger frameworks and ways of thinking that might actually be the operative thing that gets one to want to do the experiment in the first place, mm-hmm. or that gets one to think about how to frame something so that it becomes more convincing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I think about that radium story I mentioned at the beginning, right, it's a narrative of the early Earth being billions of years old and then having a more radioactive early environment. And if one has that narrative in mind, then one can imagine the experiment that one would do in order to complete it or to bring it to pass.
But the storytelling is actually reasoning before the fact.
That's right. Storytelling as reasoning before the fact. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's a feature that we could bring out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think another part of it is, one, it's a way of trying to imagine life otherwise, because it's a way of trying to remove one context and kind of plug in another context and then see what stays the same and what doesn't, right? So in that way, it is an experiment. But also with regard to form, it's a way of taking these long chunks of time and trying to just spin them out and see what happens, right? How does form change over time? So it's a way of delaminating from multiple contexts, both with regard to earthly context, but also with regard to the time in which we find ourselves.
And what aids there can be to that imaginative process of exploring the life space of possible forms of life, right? I think of an astrobiology conference a couple years ago where they said, you know, can we imagine the new continents of biodiversity? And they were analogizing to the Cambrian explosion, that just as we have all forms of biodiversity that emerge and explode at a certain moment in time, that we might be at that moment now where we are constructing it and doing it ourselves.
Right.
There's a lot one can analyze about the rhetoric of the justifications that are happening there. But I think that that analogy between something that happened in deep time and the possibility space, the logical possibilities of how life might be, even in very simple systems of what we might do, begins to suggest not only that in the astronomical universe there are these infinite possibilities for life, but that there might be astronomical possibilities within the computational universe of life, right? Within the form space of life, within whatever angle it is that one wants to focus on.
Wait, let's backtrack a little bit. So, okay, the Cambrian explosion in this analogy is an epistemic event, as in we discover an explosion of different forms,
it's or is that it that we could bring about something like that?
So we are engineering the Cambrian.
We could engineer
explosion.
It now.
It's not that we are discovering so many different things that it is as if the Earth has happened upon an extra.
Yeah. But that was said at the beginning of an astrobiology conference.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, well, that's interesting. I thought astrobiology was about finding out how life has happened in other places rather than thinking about it as something that we would engineer ourselves. And so that tension between discovering and inventing is something I'm interested in. It seems like an easy distinction. We can problematize it all we want. Mm-hmm. But one of these fields seems to be interested in discovering, the other one in engineering something. And I think there's productive areas of overlap and probably a lot more connections we're going to see in the future.
But I don't think those two things are mutually opposed, right? Mm. I mean, we started by talking about what I described as persuasive objects. And part of the point that I was making is that the epistemic and the technical can't be divided, yeah. right? Because the ability to construct new things is always part of the work of discovery. And that, you know, scientific knowledge and engineering knowledge, and this isn't new to anyone who studies history of science, but mm-hmm. those things are also inextricable.
Mm-hmm. But the ways that the fields present themselves are different than the undoings that we can do with our analysis, right? So that astrobiology is always going to be thinking about, you know, how might we find something in another place that might be an insight for us, even if all the work of constructing it is going on.
Which then goes back to the question that I posed earlier, which is how do you know it when you see it?
And I think we have a whole session that's going to come up on that later tonight, actually.
That's
so
right.
How do we know when we see it? Yeah. So is there, I want to have another story from you, another story about this intersection between these areas of inventing and discovering that's coming out of making life.
Sure.
Where do you see that as a prominent feature in what you've been researching?
Where do I see the
overlap between those things? Was there, I'm looking for an originary moment or a moment for performance right now. Where is the moment where you began to kind of realize that this was obviously intercalated for your investigators?
Well, I suppose I've thought about it in different ways at various times. The moment in my research as synthetic biologist that I realized that this was a key issue was going back to that same virus that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I'm talking about bacteriophage, which I'm sure you're familiar with, mm-hmm. right, as a kind of workhorse for experimental biology, and especially the kind of biology that was being done at mid-century, 1930s into the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So bacteriophage is something that is incredibly simple. It's a very austere virus. It's something about which molecular biologists know a lot because it's been in laboratories for so long. And as a result of that, one of the things that researchers tried to do in the mid-1990s, right, so this is the heyday of artificial life research, right, which, you know, Santa Fe, near mm-hmm. your home. So one of the things that they were working on was whether they could model the behavior of the virus, which is incredibly simple, right? Phage can only do two things. It can either hang out inside of a cell and stay there dormant, or it can explode the cell after multiplying a lot. That's it. So they were trying to model that behavior, and they couldn't do it. And what these researchers did, and these are the same people who became foundational, at least to the MIT flavor of synthetic biology that I wrote about, was say, well, if the model doesn't work, then it's because the virus is too complex. Right? So it's not our computational model is wrong. It's we need to make something that's easier to understand, because then we'll understand something about life.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously we don't understand anything about life if we can't model something like a virus, which is very simple. But the problem isn't with us, it's with
nature.
It's with life,
yeah.
In the form that life takes.
Yeah.
Which could raise all sorts of questions about what exactly they're aiming to do and what it would be a model for in the end. But it was that mode of reasoning that I found really surprising and worthy of attention.
Mm-hmm.
Right? At what point do you have to start making new things that are easier to understand in order to be able to have some kind of capture on this thing, life?
So it used to be that those surprises that you would encounter in your organism were things that you worked with, that you built with, that you did something with, right? You had the sport that appeared in the garden, and you had whatever in the orchard, right? And now it sounds like that's something to be driven out of the system. That's something that is confusing, is noise, or is something that is preventing our ability of having a complete kind of Laplacian determinism understanding of our system. Is that?
I don't know. I mean, so if you go back to the work of Hans-Jörg Reinberger,
mm-hmm.
he would say that's not the case. He would say, well, any form of experimentation requires surprise. And then he describes that as an epistemic thing, right? The epistemic thing is a machine for generating surprise. It's a machine for generating the future.
For making the future, yeah.
And right, we can try to get it to function like a technical object, to be predictable, and then it becomes a tool. But it always has that possibility of popping back into surprise.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in writing...
But the possibility of popping back into surprise in a simple system that you've removed all sources of innovation and mutation and novelty from,
yeah.
is not, in that instance, coming from the organism, Reinberger says, but the larger experimental system, right? That something in the larger entire context and world of that operational system is making that possible. It's not to reduce those innovations to just life itself.
Well, that's unclear. It depends on what counts. And I mean, if you want to do a really deep reading of Reinberger, and I've counted, he has 37 different definitions of epistemic thing, but I don't want to go over those. What I think is interesting is that, right, the experimental system as a whole generates surprise, but the important part is the thing, right, which can be an organism, or might not be, but
mm-hmm.
Moving beyond that, I think this could bring us back to this question of experimentation and life and when models function according to plan, when they don't. That brings up a larger issue of mechanism and vitalism. And I think we've already talked our way around this question, because we could accuse, you know, the people that you write about and the people that I write about of being mechanists. But that makes me think about this theological resonance.
That's so interesting, because usually it's the attacking somebody as a vitalist, which is the thing that gets done. If you don't like somebody, you call them a vitalist for the first half of the 20th century. So to accuse somebody
of
a mechanist.
I accuse people of mechanism. I can't help it. right, but so this is exactly the point, because mechanism actually has more theological resonance than vitalism. And this is something that Jessica Riskin has recently published mm-hmm. about, right? Because if you say life is like a clock, well, the clock has a designer. If you say that genetic material is like code, which means it's a text, well, that text has an author.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always someone outside the system.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with vitalism, I mean, maybe we don't know how it works, but at least it's doing its own thing.
Mm-hmm. And so vitalism is a counter to the theological implications of mechanism? Is that what you're...
Possibly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So how do we fit that into a space of life as other, on Earth as something we construct rather than what we find, and in outer space as how we might find it somewhere else? Do mechanism and vitalism work in the same way when we're talking about engineering life rather than natural life? And do they work in the same way when we talk about encountering other forms of life elsewhere? Or are those categories somehow earthbound? It's an interesting question. I've never thought about that before, but...
What would your interlocutors say? What would Simpson or Sagan say about that?
Yeah.
Or Bernal?
Yeah. I think those debates would not be the frame that they would use for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would be so deep within a mechanistic frame already that it wouldn't even occur to them to think of a way, a new term that might pull them out of it.
Right. So I think that formalizing life tends to lead to mechanism, right?
Okay.
So going back to Schrödinger's work,
mm-hmm.
right? He says, what is life? And he has lots of different definitions that have to do with thermodynamics, right? It drinks entropy, or drinks from a sea of entropy
mm-hmm.
to produce order. That kind of reasoning invites ideas about life as not having a context, right? So life and form become things that can function on their own, right? Mm-hmm. There's no more hyphen there. It's not a compound word. And so it makes sense to me that astrobiology would be founded on a kind of mechanistic principle, mm-hmm. right? Because it's not bound to Earth. It's just a physical theory, which is true across the universe.
But if we think of, and you would probably know this better than I would, of science fiction explorations of this, and Lem's Solaris or something like mm-hmm. that, right? There you have a very different, hard to categorize understanding of what is this planet? Is this a planet? Is this life? Is this something else? Where a simple categorization of mechanism or vitalism doesn't seem the right way to think about it. It's a different entity that it's not even clear should be or could be recognized as a living thing at the time, right? So even the boundaries of being able to recognize other life forms that might also be called by other names, right, as systems or as contaminants or as... I'm thinking back to that story of the radium, right? That something else got in there, and it's not what you think it is, right? It's mm-hmm. the instability in the category of life that seems to emerge at these limit cases, when we're talking about the origin of it or when we're talking about a place elsewhere that we're not sure if that's what we're recognizing. Even right now, we have the story of discovering methane on Mars, right? And this mystery of what is the source of methane on Mars, that otherwise we would have an atmospheric equilibrium and there has to be something that's producing this. And so we had a big span of newspaper stories, you know, a couple weeks ago saying, you know, where is this coming from? There must be something. Maybe there's life on Mars. And so that I think, highlights another sort of moment of what that might look like today when these instabilities begin to play out, right? Is there, in our search for biosignatures, in our search to find out something about other planetary environments that might be indicators of life, are we reproducing similar situations that we've seen before, where the application of the category as we've known it is a problem for us to try and solve our way through?
Yeah, absolutely, because yeah. we can't begin to look for something until we identify what we're looking for. But if we already have a rough definition of what we're trying to find, then we're just following this kind of constructive impulse in a way, right? Or a demonstrative impulse, because mm-hmm. we already know what we're looking for. And yeah, if we find it, then maybe that's going to show that there's life elsewhere, but certainly there are all sorts of other definitions and, you know, the yeah. theories of shadow life on Earth, and how do we know that when we see it? Well, I mean, that assumes that life is a natural category and not an epistemic thing that we made up.
So at the beginning of our discussion, I was bumped by one of our performers who were passing through in their migration. And it reminded me, I had gone to the Hamburger Bahnhof just a couple of days ago, and there was an exhibit there where I learned that an American painter in 1960 had said that a sculpture is what you bump into when you look at a painting. And I thought that was a beautiful definition of a sculpture that I'd never thought of before. And of course, preparing for today, I then thought, well, maybe that's what life is, that life is what you bump into when you're busy looking at other things or in other places. So that just came back to mind today as I see people being bumped into behind you.
And that's a perfect place to end.
There we go.